KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And this year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm very excited to have on a return guest and a new guest. The new guest is Professor Irina Manta, who's an associate professor of law and director of the Hofstra Center for Intellectual Property Law. She and her co-author, a return guest, David Olson, who's an associate professor at Boston College Law School, are on to discuss their forthcoming article entitled Hello Barbie. First they will monitor you, then they will discriminate against you perfectly. And that is the title. This is an article that is forthcoming in the Alabama Law Review. And in the article we're going to be, which we'll be discussing in detail in the interview, we're going to be taking a deep dive into an interesting and somewhat complex but important area involving the question of price discrimination. The article focuses on a very interesting and somewhat counterintuitive issue in the world of software in particular, and how software is sold and traded and ultimately acquired by consumers. There's been a long-standing concern that access to software and the ability of individuals across the consumer spectrum to have access to technology can be limited by the ability of the creators of software to engage in what's known as price discrimination. And this price discrimination can be viewed as something that would make it more difficult to actually allow for access to software by people who don't have the kind of resources necessary to acquire it. In their article, Hello Barbie, Irina and David make the counterintuitive argument that, in fact, in this world that exists today, particularly given the Internet of Things, manufacturers of software and consumer goods will actually be able to use the technologies that we are also quite concerned about, involving monitoring consumer behavior and controlling the use of software through licenses in a way that will lead to better pricing for individuals and therefore allow for more, or at least more fair access to software. So this article is one that touches on a number of issues that we've talked about on Hearsay Culture over the last several years, not just the world of software and code, but also the questions involving surveillance and consumer protection and privacy that have come up repeatedly on the show. It also touches on important considerations involving licensing and how contracts are formed on the internet, which has been an occasional topic on this show, and which, of course, remains an enormous problem. And so in the article, David and Irina go through not only the history of software development, but also the core arguments that they're making for how, in fact, price discrimination will work more efficiently and for better social good through the theories that they propose. So when you think about this, I don't want you to think about it as a listener purely in terms of economics, although we'll talk about some of the economics, but more broadly about the ability of individuals to access the technology which is so pervasive today. From the dawn of the modern commercial internet, there's been a generally held belief that truth will out and more information will move through the internet and more acquisition of information will occur, and that therefore that will lead to the world improving. That has not always been the case, and more recently, of course, we've had very dire concerns about how the internet can be used and technology can be used in ways that, in fact, go against that social good. And so there's been an enormous focus on this show and, of course, internationally on people like Edward Snowden and the revelations that come out of his work through NSA surveillance. All of these kinds of issues become important in a discussion involving price discrimination. And so we're going to dig into the arguments that Irina and David make in this article, and I think come out with a very interesting theory and one that deserves a lot of attention. So, again, by way of that background, Irina D. Manta is an associate professor at Hofstra's Center for Intellectual Property Law. And David, who was a fellow with me literally 10 years ago now at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford, is a Boston College law professor. Irina is joining us via Skype from New York, and David is joining us via Skype from Brazil. We are recording this show on April 23rd, 2015, for airing next week. Irina and David, thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Hey, Dave, it's my pleasure. It's good to be here. I love the show.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much for having us.
Irina, let's start off here with your background. And why don't you talk a bit about your background and why David and you wrote this piece together?
So my background is that I'm an intellectual property scholar who has mostly been focusing on copyright, trademarks, and criminal sanctions in intellectual property. But I'm also interested in property law, and I also teach in that area. Whereas David has been working on IP issues, mainly in patents and copyright, and also on antitrust. And so our background seemed like a great way to deal with issues having to do with IP, licensing, price discrimination, and servitudes.
And David, do you want to add anything in terms of your interest in getting into this article?
I just overlaps nicely with my areas of interest in IP and in antitrust law and in economics, law and economics. And as we'll discuss, I'm sure, in a little bit, to me, this project was kind of, it was good to get together on it because to me, this project is kind of the, how I learned to relax and love the bomb. It's how I learned to relax and accept the pervasive internet monitoring and actually find, some silver lining in it.
So that's a topic that we actually will talk about a bit. The acceptance of the monitoring that, as we know, many people are concerned about is something I think that is worthy of more discussion. Irina, let's dive right in because I attempted to introduce this topic, but of course you can tailor what I said appropriately. What is the basic claim that you're making in this piece?
Sure. So what we're saying is that while people have concerns about the consumer monitoring in which companies have been engaging, and that's been increasing in this age of the Internet of Things, we believe that the monitoring will actually allow for ever improving price discrimination, which will allow poorer people to have better access to products that they otherwise couldn't afford. Additionally, we argue that the worries over excessive use of software licenses to control consumers' ability to use and resell goods are overblown because the market will actually constrain that kind of behavior.
So let's put a little context on this before we define some terms. Broadly speaking, as I mentioned, the claim that you're making sounds counterintuitive, and perhaps Irina, you could, or David, could kind of frame the piece in the broader context of what scholarship has been saying generally. I recognize that that could be in the entire discussion generally about this topic. How is it that you might see your initial claim as being counterintuitive given what we think we know about the market for software?
I think there have been two types of concerns in the broader scholarship. One, as you mentioned, having to do with privacy, and the other one having to do with concerns about price discrimination more generally. So when it comes to the privacy angle, a lot of people think that the data will be misused by companies, that people will not necessarily receive enough notice of what is going to happen to their data, and so that we could have a lot of negative consequences. And then when it comes to price discrimination, some people don't really like knowing that they don't get the same price for something as somebody else. So they don't like knowing that they paid more for a certain airplane ticket based on some data that was collected about them than somebody else did. But we believe that in the aggregate, it's actually an economic positive, and that it's especially poorer people who end up benefiting from it because they get services at a lower price that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford at all.
So, Irina, I want to come back to you in a second with regard to the title and the Barbie story that kind of frames your discussion. But before I do that, I realize I think it would be useful, perhaps I ask David. David, what is the basic definition of price discrimination from economics that applies here to this discussion? Irina, I think, alluded to it, but what would be a clear and perhaps a slightly more detailed definition of this concept?
Sure. If you looked in Palsgrave's Dictionary for Economics or something, it's going to define price discrimination as charging different prices for goods and those price differences not being based in different costs. So the easy way to think about it is selling the same good for different prices. So easy examples are movie theater tickets. You know, you give discounts to older people and younger people. Why? Because you think that they aren't willing to pay as more or don't have as much money. Same with, you know, discounts on restaurants. The airlines that Irina talked about will charge more for a ticket that does not have a Saturday stayover because they're trying to determine who are business travelers and probably willing to pay more to get home by the weekend and who are leisure travelers who probably are not willing to pay as much. So price discrimination is just the attempt by the producer or manufacturer to get more money out of people who are willing to pay more. And that's why a lot of people don't like it, because you know, sometimes you'll hear it described as fleecing or milking or various terms, negative terms. But it also has a benefit, and that's, or it can have a benefit. There's some dispute as to how often it's beneficial, how often it's overall net harmful. But what we particularly point out in this article is that when it comes to software, there's a much greater chance that price discrimination is going to be end up being net positive. And that's because the marginal cost of distributing software is so low. And that low marginal cost means that if you can price discriminate, you'd like to sell to everyone you can sell to for whatever they're willing to pay. That means you charge rich people more, but it also means that if you can do it and keep them from reselling, you would charge people who are willing to pay very little, so long as they're willing to pay above the cost of distribution, which approaches zero for software. So in the case of software and for Internet of Things software-enabled devices, where you're also going to have patent and copyright protection, and therefore the the kind of standard or market price of the good is probably much more than the production price. In both those cases, we argue that price discrimination can end up giving us much more diffusion of technology and of software and benefit to those people who are able or willing to pay less.
So, Irina, let me come back to you with that kind of, you know, general economic definition of price discrimination. Your title refers to Hello Barbie, which I think is a really interesting story that allows, I think, listeners to understand, you know, the classic radio question of why should I care? So why don't you tell the Barbie story and the concerns that it raises for David and you?
So as we were writing this article, Mattel created a new doll that was called Hello Barbie that apparently records children and then sends that information back to the company to allow it to customize the doll and make it into the child's best friend. So this information gets transmitted over the internet, and people were very concerned about the privacy implications of Mattel receiving that kind of internet information. And that they might also get information about other conversations that happen in people's homes or just hear all sorts of things that really a company should not be hearing. And so this hit the press, and there were a number of news stories about it. Personally, I just wouldn't buy the doll. And, you know, we're going to see if other consumers feel the same way about it. But we thought this would be a nice way to lead into our topic and this issue of monitoring.
So to be clear, so when one purchases this doll, they know that the doll is going to do this, correct? In other words, the doll is marketed as you allude to, it's going to become the friend of the child that owns it because Mattel's going to be able to better, you know, personalize the doll to the child. Am I right about that generally?
That's right.
Okay, so the issue though is not that the doll is doing this, is it? It's more about the information that's moving between the child and the corporate entity through this Internet of Things issue. And so that's where I think it's helpful to understand the core of your argument. How does the Barbie doll, putting aside, I mean, what I will say is a fairly creepy concept anyway, but then again, you know, we evolve as humans, and probably several years from now we won't think of it as weird as at least I think of it now. But what is the Internet of Things angle on this that, again, raises the concerns that you're addressing in the piece?
So I think this was a bit of an extreme example of a company engaging in monitoring. It became especially unpopular with some people because it involved children, naturally. And, you know, from our point of view, right, if this kind of product is something that people do not like, as long as they're on notice, which here they very clearly are, as you pointed out, they're just not going to buy it. So as I was saying earlier, I would not buy this product for my child. And so to the extent that some companies will engage in excessive monitoring, generally, the market will punish that behavior. If it tries to restrict what people can do with their goods excessively, they're just not going to be able to do that as long as people are on notice. Here, they very much are, I think, both when they buy the good, but also because it received a lot of media attention. But there are a lot of other contexts where the data that is collected is completely innocuous and really allows the companies to tailor services much better to people's needs, and that's beneficial. Or, yes, there are situations in which companies will use this information to restrict what people can do with their products, depending on pricing. But not everybody needs all of the features of a particular product. And you know, one of the examples we give from before the Internet of Things is Microsoft selling different packages of Office to different kinds of people at different price levels. So, you know, you have Microsoft Office Student Edition, and that's going to cost less and is going to come with less capability than the business version. But that's okay. And because the company can engage in monitoring of what goes on the other end, both for Internet of Things products, but also software products generally, it's able to maintain this kind of price discrimination in a way that it couldn't otherwise, and it's able to offer those products at lower prices to people who have lower means.
This Internet of Things, you know, phrase, which I think has become popular over the last couple of years, you know, is an interesting one because it's basically referring to things other than computers and mobile communication devices having access to the Internet. I'm not sure that it means more than that. Do you agree, Irina? Does Internet of Things connote something beyond what I've just said?
And the Internet of Things has been a term used fairly generally to refer to the constellation of goods that contain software or other electronic devices that allow the goods to communicate back with the manufacturer or communicate with one another, usually with the goal of providing a greater level of service.
So, David, let's turn with one more definitional question before we get into it. So we've got this broad issue, or maybe Irina, you want to take it, of software licensing and how it works, which to understand, I think, the core of your argument, the listener has to have a basic understanding of it. So what is the general framework for acquisition of software by consumers when they purchase it versus perhaps a large corporate entity that's buying software for, you know, hundreds of machines?
Sure. we talk about in the article a combination of monitoring and using software licenses to really restrict what people can do with their goods. We're used to, when we buy a refrigerator, we're used to being able to do whatever we want with it, right? We can resell it. We can use it in a business. We can use it at home. What we contend is that the use of licensing of software and the restrictions that can come with those licenses is going to allow manufacturers to be much more restrictive or place much more restraints on what people can do with their goods in a way that could very well shock, anger, and offend people. And we're not the first ones to say this by any means. Christina Mulligan has a paper where she talks about this. What we do in our paper is then come to the conclusion that this can be good and that the worst alleged abuses from this will probably not come to pass. So why is software licensing important? Well, as you know, Dave, software, for a while when software was first being sold, you got it on a floppy disk, you took it home, you used it, that was it. And so was it a sale? What was somebody licensing you their copyrighted code? That was a subject of dispute. There were a number of court cases. In the end, the courts pretty much decided that they would allow companies, software producers, to license their software and therefore maintain many restrictions, even though there was a pretty decent argument that these really didn't have the characteristics of something that was being licensed with an ongoing relationship and any of that, but that instead it looked like a sale. Nevertheless, courts agreed with the software producers and allowed this software to be licensed, which meant that the producers could restrict, most importantly, resale of the software. So for most copyrighted goods, once they're sold once, you can resell them. That's why we get to have used bookstores. If I buy a book, I can go resell my copy. For software, that's not the case. You, as pretty much everyone knows, if you try to resell the software that you buy, say you still buy it on a CD or a disc, which is getting more and more rare, if you put it on eBay when you're done with it and try to resell it, you may get a nasty surprise in that you're served with a lawsuit, or if you do it in a wide-scale way, you will get, you know, maybe the federal marshals will show up at your door because you are not allowed to resell your software because you've been considered not to have bought the software, but merely to have licensed the use thereof. Well, once you take this and apply it to that same kind of approach to all the Internet of Things goods that will have software, and you say, well, look, you're not just buying a refrigerator, you're buying the software that comes with it, and we're only licensing the use of that software, and you can't resell it, and you can't use the software in ways that we say you can't. And furthermore, as part of the contract to get the right to use the software, you agree not to do this and that with your refrigerator. Well, once you do all of those sort of things, then consumers can really be restricted in what they do with their goods in a way that was not possible before software was on them and before people started using restrictive software licenses.
We're chatting with Irina Manta and David Olson, co-authors of the article Hello Barbie, First They Will Monitor You, Then They Will Discriminate Against You Perfectly, forthcoming in the Alabama Law Review on KZSU-FM Stanford. So, David, let's dive in now to a claim that you mentioned earlier that I think frames a fair amount of the article, and one which I think you freely admit is somewhat controversial. You begin the article by asserting that increased monitoring individuals, as you alluded to, through consumer products is inevitable. Now, there, as you know, have been and continue to be concerted efforts on the part of privacy advocates and consumer protection organizations and the like to challenge that, right? Not just from consumer products, but indeed the kinds of surveillance that occurs at the law enforcement level. So I guess my question really is, why? Why is it, in your view, that this kind of increased monitoring of individuals through consumer products is inevitable?
Sure, that's a good question. Let me start out by saying I don't think it's a good thing. I don't like it. I think I maybe take a darker view of it than Irina does. I don't like people knowing what I'm doing online, where I am in the world, who I'm talking to. All that, I think, go against some basic notions of privacy that traditionally have been very important in this country to people. But I'm very pessimistic that, such privacy will continue. I think that monitoring is going to only increase, and I don't think that law and regulations will stop it, because I think people will give away their privacy rights even when they have legal protections. Sorry if you can hear that background noise. I'm in Rio de Janeiro, and the looks like it's the time of day where the trash trucks come through.
That was a trash truck. Okay, well, thank you for the clarification. So
there you go.
It happens. I've interviewed people in cities, so no worries.
I'm also smelting some Internet of Things devices in the background. Anyway, Hello Barbie, I think, is the perfect example. She's super creepy. I would never buy her. Of course, the privacy and kind of child welfare experts, are up in arms about it. But look, Mattel's still rolling it out. It's supposed to come out this summer. It's going to be $70 a pop. And maybe I'll be surprised, but I expect it to do very well. What we've seen on Facebook, what we've seen with Google products, what we've seen in lots and lots of products, is people are very happy to give away any privacy rights they have in return for some, service or good they want. And so I think lots of parents will think Hello Barbie is super nifty, And the fact that you have basically an update on George Orwell's 1984, where instead of the television watching people, there's a doll that's given to every child, and the child carries around and reports on conversations that are had by parents in its proximity. The fact that sounds like dystopian science fiction, and it's here already, and I expect it to be a commercial success, tells me that we shouldn't have high hopes to avoid monitoring.
Irina, David alluded to perhaps having a darker view of these issues than you do. So do you want to add your own perspective on this?
Well, I think that David's and my views are dark in different places, perhaps. And the reason I say that is perhaps, I mean, I don't know whether I'm more concerned than he is, but I definitely am concerned about, not necessarily so much what the companies will do with that data, although we've certainly seen some abuse in that area as well, but more whether, the sheer fact that that data will be stored somewhere will give the government easy access to some of these things. And that's an area that I am very worried about and that I'm, where I'm not certain that Fourth Amendment protections will really be upheld based on some of the things we've seen in the past. And so certainly that's a worry for me. We do have to wonder whether there are some situations in which people really understand what happens with their data. So to give one example, there's been a fair deal of criticism when Facebook changes its policies in ways that are not always very transparent. In parts of that, they've been responsive to this, but perhaps not enough so for people's preferences. But I do agree with David that ultimately, whether we like it or not, and perhaps some of this is generational, sort of the younger people today are really not that concerned about good parts of their privacy. There are some initiatives out there trying to educate them on some privacy issues. So Joel Rydenberg at Fordham and some others are very entrepreneurial in this area, but it's an uphill battle, certainly. And so that's part of why I think, we really might be dealing with something that's just going to end up happening one way or another.
So let me give a pushback example and see what your reaction is to it. Because I was, as both of you were answering, I was thinking about the failure of Google Glass. The product that Google really put a ton of time and effort and marketing into. That at this point, again, we're recording in April of 2015, is off the market. It seemed to me that the primary reason why it was pulled off the market is that people found it to be too intrusive to have a computer on, basically wearing on their face, and aside from the stylistic issues of it, found that it was going too far in an intrusion into what it is to be human. I recognize that may not be the only reason, but I'll ask either of you. I don't know who wants to take it or who wants to address it first. But is that a counterexample such that not that because I'm not asking you to predict the future, but that there is at least some evidence that perhaps there are limits. That the Hello Barbie scenario and really more broadly the intrusion and monitoring might reach a threshold point where consumers will say, no, this is too much?
I mean, I can start with this. I do think that there are some products that go too far. Google Glass may have been one of them, although I wonder sometimes how much of that was cosmetic, right? Mm-hmm. It was literally in your face. And so people didn't really appreciate that. They felt that it would change the interaction with the other person. That being said, oftentimes you still can't really control what people are doing with some of their other devices, whether it's legal or illegal. And so in that sense, that some of that data might be still gathered in other ways that might be a little less aesthetically intrusive, but are achieving a lot of the same goals nonetheless.
David, you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're not saying by any means that every attempt at monitoring is going to be successful. Of course not. Things are going to get pushback. Some things are going to get outrage. I don't know if it was Fitbit, but some of the fitness devices that allow you to log your calories and whatnot, people were logging all sorts of things, like, how many, had sexual intercourse for however many minutes. How many calories is that? And the way Fitbit had its privacy settings, if it was Fitbit, so hopefully I've got that right, But anyway, the way the manufacturer and device provider had the privacy settings, people didn't realize they were sharing all this information. So that was pretty unpopular. And of course, they changed, right? So market forces are going to be powerful here. And certainly the kind of direct sharing of information, we'll see pushback, and that'll be restricted at times. The data that's being mined and used that we don't really realize is going on, that I think is going to continue to be very pervasive. But one more thing to say is there's, of course, fads in technology like anything else. Google hoped that their glass would be perceived as really cool and awesome. Instead, it ended up getting the story of, you know, dorky, toolish, maybe even kind of pervy, privacy invasion kind of device. And that really has sunk it for now.
We're chatting with Irina Manta and David Olson, co-authors of the article "Hello Barbie: First They Will Monitor You, Then They Will Discriminate Against You Perfectly," on KZSU-FM, Stanford University. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to listen to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to the webpage for the radio station and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, please continue to listen to the station as well as to the show. So David, and I think the follow-up is going to be directly to Irina. One area that we haven't talked about yet, and it frames your proposal and your analysis, which we're going to talk about shortly, is copyright law and how copyright law fits into this. So before, Irina, I ask you about the first sale doctrine, which I'll ask you to define. How does copyright, David, fit into this broader issue of software licenses, and how has copyright been used to restrict consumers' ability to use software as they see fit?
Copyright law is key to the ability to have restrictive software licenses and therefore to price discriminate with any kind of granularity. If it weren't for copyright protection for software, none of that would be possible. And, you know, what would we see? We would see people have to sell their software without the ability to protect against copying. And so what would that look like? You know, maybe some contract agreements, maybe some trade secrecy. It would be a very different landscape, and one worries about whether we'd have nearly as much production of software. It wasn't at all inevitable that copyright would be held to cover software. Of course, you know, going way back to the White Music case, the court originally said, look, if it's not readable by humans, then it's not really a copy that's subject to copyright law. Congress overturned that with the 1909 Copyright Act, and subsequent courts then interpreted any kind of writing that's fixed to include software, even though, you know, quite obviously early copyright law, the intention seemed to be to cover works of literature and then music and then, you know, kind of artistic works and whatnot. But now we have this utilitarian thing, which is software that's subject to copyright law. And with copyright law, when we layer on the ability also to license instead of to sell, now you have this ability to say, look, anytime you reproduce it, you're violating my copyright. Anytime you have a performance or a, you know, public display of it, you could be violating my copyright. So copyright coverage gives a lot of ability to control and restrict the use of software.
So, Irina, with that in mind, you know, one of the areas that we see in copyright that's an enormous issue is the first sale doctrine, which generally says that once one purchases a copy of a copyrighted work, like, for example, a book, right, as Dave was alluding to earlier, you can resell that book. The first sale doctrine doesn't work very well or really at all with software. And in fact, it's been an enormous issue, both why it doesn't exist and then efforts from entities like Redigi to allow for some kind of first sale concept to exist, at least with regard to music. What is the first sale doctrine, and how, again, does the first sale doctrine, or the absence of it in the case of software, amplify the argument you're making?
Sure. So if software is sold as opposed to licensed, then the seller can't restrict what the buyer does with it afterwards. So if you have a piece of software and it's resold indefinitely, the seller is probably going to impose a higher price on it in the first place because he knows that he will make fewer sales total as a result of that. So the seller becomes less able to engage in price discrimination, and he has to try and make more money upfront from a single buyer. In the Redigi case, which dealt with the resale of music tracks that were purchased from iTunes, the court said that it was indeed all right for the seller to impose said restriction. And so buyers were able to buy these tracks for a lower price in the first place as a result of the licensing restriction. But the flip side was that they're not able to resell. And, you know, some of them did not like that. But we're saying they got the benefit in the beginning, and so now they kind of want to have their cake and eat it too.
And so therefore, this combination of restrictive software licensing, right, by agreeing to terms on how software is going to be used, combined with copyright, gives enormous power to software manufacturers to control prices and therefore restrict the ability of individuals and entities to acquire software, much less use it. Which leads us now to in more detail, to your theory. With regard to that theory, David, what are the precedents for making the argument that price discrimination could actually work well in this environment of software?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, when it comes to price discrimination generally, price discrimination can be positive in just the, you know, plain old world of copier machines or, you know, computers, airline tickets, all that sort of thing. Certainly, you know, William Fisher, Terry Fisher at Harvard has written extensively about the benefit to poor people and people in the developing world of price discrimination when it comes to drugs. Because, again, the idea of letting a drug manufacturer make up its costs of research and development in the developed world by charging, you know, relatively high prices, but then being able to restrict resale and reimportation and, you know, sell drugs for just above cost in the developing world, Terry Fisher is very bullish on, because he really wants to see more diffusion of drugs. Well, the reason it works so well for drugs is because the cost of producing the drug and going through FDA trials is so much higher than the cost of actually, once you set it up, producing, 20 more pills or something like that. So because that marginal cost of distribution is so low relative to the all-in cost of research and development, you can expect that if price discrimination is possible and reimportation is prevented, you may get a lot more sales to poorer countries than otherwise, and to poorer people in poorer countries. So software is like that, except to a more extreme. Software, the cost of distribution approaches zero. You just need your servers, a tiny bit of, you know, electricity per copy, a little bit, you know, some bandwidth, and that's all it takes to distribute the software. So because the marginal cost is so very low, if you could make sales, right? So if I can make a sale, if I know that someone's using Microsoft Word, let's say, and there's two adults in the family and they have a six-year-old child who's just beginning to tap away at some things. If I could monitor who's using the device, and if I could charge a little bit extra to give access to the child, then if I'm Microsoft, I'd be happy to do that, right? So right now, Microsoft does that in a less granular way by just giving a home license that allows you to have up to 5 devices and anyone can use on those devices. But you could easily see them giving rights per person or per devices, really becoming much more granular in their price discrimination. Now, if they wanted to charge me $20 for my 5-year-old, I probably wouldn't do it. But if they wanted to charge only $5 more and they did it in a way that didn't seem terribly obtrusive, or, you know, had to monitor me by using the camera on my computer or something, if there was something more basic, if we go to having you use the fingerprint touch like Apple uses on their iPhones, that might not seem like a big deal to me. And suddenly not just 5-year-olds, but people who, you know, aren't going to pay $99 for Microsoft Office because they're fairly poor, but would pay, you know, $30 or something, and Microsoft can figure out who that is, can prevent them from reselling, and can charge them that lower price. You know, it's in every interest of Microsoft to do so. Now, it also means that, you know, those who can pay more will pay more, right? So the rich get soaked a little bit here, if you want to use that terminology, under price discrimination, because if Microsoft can figure out, you know, this person really uses our product a lot, and if we can lock them down from buying anywhere else and can only offer them the kind of access to it through us, they might pay $200 a year, you know, instead of some other price. So it could happen on both ends. I think the market will cap and competition will cap some how much on the high end you really see people getting singled out and charged more. But on the low end, I think competition will really allow software diffusion to be unleashed. And I think the same will go, the same will go for Internet of Things devices, at least some of them, although to a little bit lesser extent, because the marginal cost of distributing an Internet of Thing product is obviously higher than the cost of distributing software.
So, Irina, you know, as I was reading the article, I was thinking about, you know, other scenarios where you have this kind of very dynamic software price discrimination along the lines of software. You think about scenarios where software is made available via the internet, and the prices, you know, can change almost minute to minute, depending on the day or the hour. And I was thinking about other sites that offer those kinds of opportunities for price discrimination that consumers might be able to control a bit more, like auction sites or discount travel services. Are those appropriate comparators to the software market that you envision?
You're right to point out that a number of these sites engage in price discrimination of their own. So, travel sites differentiating on price depending on how far in advance people want to book, or depending on whether individuals are willing to stay at a hotel if all they know is it has 3 stars and it's roughly in this part of the city, but they don't know its name. And then you have the auction sites, as you mentioned, like eBay, which can sell the same good to different people at different prices. So depending on how risk tolerant or intolerant people are, they might click the buy now button, right, and pay a higher price. Or they might engage in bidding with, you know, the risk of losing out on the item, but the hope that they might also get it for a lower price. So in that sense, there is price discrimination going on in all of these examples. What's special about the example of software that we discuss in our article is that, as David just mentioned, software has a minimal marginal cost of distribution, which enables more beneficial price discrimination because the bottom prices offered can indeed be very low.
Leading us, I guess, to, you know, concerns or at least questions with regard to this broad issue of social benefit, which is broadly this, you know, at the same time that these effects might exist, right? And I know you're not suggesting that it's impossible, but a given seller could simply choose to ignore it and set a static price that simply is, this is the price and that's it. Is that a legitimate concern in the world of software, or do you envision that simply by virtue of market dynamics, the chances of that happening are exceedingly low? Because I'm sure others can point to, and you probably dealt with it in discussing it, people saying, well, what about this market where that doesn't happen at all? What's your response to those kinds of arguments? Basically say, well, you know what? Software manufacturers aren't as rational as you're making them out to be.
So that's a good question. I wouldn't characterize software manufacturers as being irrational, however, if they offer set pricing, right? So some consumers definitely prefer that. Some consumers become very upset or offended if they feel like they're paying a higher price than someone else. And so if we look at sales of new cars, for instance, you see some auto sellers have gone to that model to try to cater to that part of the market, the kind of, you know, people who either hate to haggle or hate the idea that they're having to pay more than someone else. And so we see that as part of the auto sales market, but not by any means the greater part. So we could certainly see market segmentation. Some sellers might come on and say, look, we offer the same price to everyone. That's great. Others may price discriminate quite a bit more. Really, the challenge, the thing that would allow less price discrimination and therefore less benefit to those who are able to pay the very least is this kind of consumer pushback, consumer anger sort of thing. So, you know, there are recently in the news, the Keurig coffee machine. There's kind of a classic going along the lines of an Internet of Things device. The new Keurig coffee machine can tell whether you're using official Keurig coffee pods or those from a competitor. Why? Because Keurig wants to price discriminate. They want to charge a lower price for the coffee maker and then make up, have those who love the product more pay more. How do they do that? Well, you probably love the product more if you're drinking three times as much coffee from it as opposed to someone else. So those people would over time pay more money. Well, that's had a huge kind of backlash from consumers, and there's been self-help as well as consumers have figured out how to trick the machine into thinking the pods are official. So, you know, there's going to be pushback. It might end up that Keurig gets enough pushback from it. They decide the price discrimination isn't worth it. That's going to happen at times in the market. But at other times, you're really going to get, along with price discrimination, some real product specialization and some customization to serve consumers. So I might get, but you know, in order to charge me more for my version of Office, or you know, an architectural, you know, an AutoCAD program, or my Maps program, or for my you know restaurant review app, the producer might do something like, charge more if you decide to have it more fine-grained. How can it tell other customers like me and what restaurants they like? And how can it give even more detail on pricing? And how can it, you know, give me up-to-the-minute kind of wait times at restaurants? Or who knows what they'll do? But a way that producers often try to price discriminate is by adding some levels of service or some levels of applications to the device. And so that if they're successful in doing that, they'll both be successful in price discriminating because people will think, oh, I'm not paying for exactly the same thing as someone else and paying a lot more. Instead, they'll think, ooh, I'm getting the luxury level version of this app or this good or whatever it is, and that's worth it to me. And in that case, it'll be they won't get the pushback. But also the market will be benefiting because it won't be pure price discrimination. It will be incentivizing producers to actually give more customization and more service, which should benefit the high-value users as well as the low-value users.
Irina and David, we've entered into what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions that you don't have time to answer adequately. But I'm going to ask them anyway. And I'm going to turn to you, Irina, and ask, you know, I've been, again, going through a series of several alternative products and markets where your theory might play out to see what your thoughts are. You know, you've got an entity like Apple, for example, you know, which in my view is the king of use restrictions. I mean, I own an iPhone and an iPad, and unless I, you know, root these by literally breaking into the device in order to change its operating system, everything I acquire for these devices must be acquired through Apple. Can my, you know, iPad or iPhone hardware be something that can be used in a way that would allow for price discrimination? Does your theory translate to those kinds of seriously and heavily locked down hardware?
No, Apple has managed to strike a balance in its restrictions that many consumers accept. And, you know, to some extent, there are ways to get around some of the things you mentioned, and get around them legally, I mean. You know, some people might install the Kindle app on their phone to get ebooks more cheaply than through the Apple app. So it's not quite so black and white on some of these things. But, you know, for some people, even the restrictions that are there are too much. And, they prefer to go with different brands, right? And they don't go with Apple, and Apple knows that, and it loses a share of market as a result. The fact of the matter is that prices would be higher for Apple products if there were fewer restrictions and not as many people could buy them. So even of the ones that could buy them, but they would just have to spend more, quite a few prefer to pay a lower price in exchange for some limitations.
So let's turn now in the last few minutes that we have to kind of think a little bit in a more forward direction. Irina, you know, given your article, which I think, like I said in my introduction, as I was reading through it, I think this is a pretty counterintuitive argument, yet I think you make a good case for it. Would there come a time where you would back law and regulation in this space? I mean, short of having predicted or analyzed incorrectly, which is possible whenever any of us do analysis of the law and try to figure out what's going on. But short of something like that, do you see a place for law and regulation in the software market?
Well, I think that, you know, these are things that we need to look at on a case-by-case basis. And as different problems arise, if we end up feeling like the market can't solve them, you know, there could be a time for reasonable regulation. Certainly, I believe that companies should have to put consumers on notice, and that there should be mechanisms to punish companies that don't, and to make them, you know, compensate consumers accordingly, because that's a very important piece of the puzzle for this to function in a way that is fair. I don't know if David has some additional thoughts on that as well.
What's your take on that, David?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand the question. I mean, this area is full of law and regulation. We've just talked about how copyright law, interpretation of software, and the ability to license has all made this all possible.
Let me be more clear then, yeah, because I realize that's ambiguous. What I mean is, right, by law and regulation in this space, what I'm suggesting is that we have a market which allows for fluidity in pricing, but there, as you know, are efforts made by consumer advocates and groups like EFF to limit somewhat the ability of manufacturers to be able to engage in the kind of discrimination which again you're arguing has a social benefit to happen. So recognizing, and you're right to say that there's plenty of regulation, do you think that this is a space that needs more regulation, or is it an area where you think we have enough and we should let the market do what it's doing?
Yeah, I mean, so to the extent you're saying, here's something that's going on, the underlying legal framework allows the market to function in this way, and should government step in further and say, you know, wait, we don't like how these transactions are being freely entered into between people, and we want to dictate more exactly what the market does, mm-hmm. I think, no, definitely not. I think, you know, sadly, the history of some regulation when it comes to whether it be surge pricing or price discrimination or price increases to deal with sudden shortage is the history of people saying, hey, more people paying higher prices, at least in short term, sounds bad to us, so let's make a law that prohibits that. And so often that has been short-sighted and has actually led to worse results. So, you know, I think it's a bad idea, but if, I guess as Irina said, if some particular case came up where there's some particular need or some argument that the market is failing in that instance, then I think we'd have to look at the evidence and decide.
We're just about out of time, Irina and David, but I will ask you, Irina, next projects that you have going.
Yeah, well, we're working on a number of exciting projects. Some of them have to do with music licensing, and in particular how compulsory licensing hampers music creation and distribution, which follows up on some of the issues we raised recently in an op-ed that we co-wrote with Aloe Black that was published in the Chicago Tribune. And then we're also, separately from all this, taking a look at the emerging property law regime in the favelas or shanty towns of Rio de Janeiro.
So there you have a pretty wide-ranging, and dare I say, you know, a burgeoning scholarly relationship, which I'm glad to have been able to discuss here in its early days. You know, David and Irina are both scholars who I know and respect. I consider them both friends. I am excited to have had you on the show to discuss your article, Hello, Barbie. First, they will monitor you. Then they will discriminate against you perfectly. Irina, professor at Hofstra Law, and David, a professor at Boston College, at the moment spending time in Brazil. Thank you for joining me today on the show, David. Thanks. It's always great to chat with you, Irina, as well. I appreciate you taking the time today to talk about a pretty complex topic, but one that I think deserves a lot of attention. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Rick.
I have a number of guests coming up on the show for the rest of the quarter. But before I do that, this is the first show I'm recording after the new version of Hearsay Culture's website has been launched. I've written a bit about it already, which by the time you've heard this show, the website's been around for about a week. But I do on air want to thank in particular Brandon Fry and William Monner of Elon's iMedia program for the amount of work and the quality of work that they put in rebuilding the site. I basically said, here is what I would like to see, and they ran with it, and the results, I think, are phenomenal. So thank you, Brandon and William, for that great work. And anyone, I encourage you to check out the webpage, and if you have any thoughts about it, go to the new contact form that exists on the page. For the remainder of the quarter, some great guests coming up next week. Professor Peter Asaro of the School of Media Studies at the New School on Killer Robots, Professor Arvind Narayanan of Princeton University on Algorithmic Computing and Bitcoin. At mid-May, Jacob Silverman, author of the new book Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection. At the end of the month, Professor Biela Coleman of McGill University, author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. Rounding out June, Professor Margot Kaminsky of the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law on International Trade Surveillance and Artificial Intelligence. And then at the end of the quarter, in mid-June, Professor Jason Arnold of Virginia Commonwealth University, author of Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws. I'm in the process now of booking guests for the summer on KZSU, which begins in July. If you have any suggestions on guests that I should have on, again, please contact me by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter, you can listen at 4 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or 90.1 FM if you're in the Bay Area. Or you can get the show via podcast by going to Stanford's Center for Internet Society iTunes page or by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Or you can get all previous 234 now shows by going to hearsayculture.com. Again, comments, questions, suggestions, feedback at david@hearsayculture.com or the new contact form on Hearsay Culture. That's the show for today. Thank you for listening in. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.